Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Spoiler Warning Podcast. This is review number 760 with a review of Dune Part 2. I'm Christopher Schnazy.
And I'm Stephen Miller.
And if you're joining us for the first time, the Spoiler Warning Podcast is a weekly film review program. Each week on the show, we're going to dive in, debate, discuss, and argue over the latest films coming to a theater near you. This week, we are back to talk about the second half of the film Dune. Dune Part 2. Stephen, you excited for this episode?
I am, yeah. I liked Dune. I'm not going to say part one because I'm not supposed to, but I liked the prior Dune that was not directed by David Lynch quite a bit. I had no serious complaints about it. I just looked. I gave it a must-see on the podcast. We both did. Yeah. And then I completely erased it from my brain, and I had no feelings about it for the rest of my life. And when part two was coming out, I was like, okay, fine. Sci-fi epic, whatever. Don't care. But I was excited because it's the Evil New, but I'm not sci-fi epic guy. It just isn't usually my jam. But I'm still excited to talk about this movie.
Yeah, you know, it's kind of funny because in my head, it's not that I erased it. In my head, it was a thing where I was so turned off by the, like, suddenly realizing it was half a movie. Like, at the end of the movie, that, like, that is kind of what has stuck with me back in my head. And I rewatched it, you know, right before going to see the new one in theaters. And
on what?
I watched it. I'll get to it in a second.
Okay.
But I rewatched it and I was like, that movie kicked ass. And I went back and listened to our review and I was like, oh, okay. I did think it kicked ass in the moment. Like, in my head, with distance, all I could remember was the... I think at the time, because that was, like, one of the first, like, huge films that came out during COVID times in theaters, to me, it felt like one of those things where, like, in real time, I was like, we had no guarantee that they would ever make the second half of this. And I was so angry about that, that it clouded my memory of how much I actually genuinely enjoyed the film. So I was pleasantly surprised to go back and listen to myself actually being stoked about the film. And yes, complain about it being half a movie, but also still genuinely in the moment, still super like it and give it a must-see.
Yeah, I was very surprised. When I was surprised to see I gave it a must-see, I was very surprised to see you did, because my memory was also of you really not liking the half a movie thing, and you had watched the David Lynch version too, and it felt like it a kind of Christopher way of, can I make the plot make sense, because right now I hate it style, and in my memory, it was you tearing it apart.
Yeah,
you gave it a must-see. You were super into it. We've just both COVID hold like everything we knew about Dune.
Going on into kind of what you were teasing at is, so when I rewatched Dune, the first the 2021 film, I keep doing that, to me 2021 is 2001 for some reason. But anyways, so I watched 2021's Dune in the Apple Vision Pro in 3D, and it fucking kicked ass. I'm like so stoked for the possibility of watching this next film in 3D. I'm just hoping that, like, there is an official IMAX app in the Apple Vision Pro, and so far they haven't put, like, you know, quote unquote real movies out on it. It's all like nature documentaries and stuff like that. But I really would love to be able to have that experience of watching this film in IMAX, but in the headset, having that, like, perfectly bright as shit screens right there, and getting, like, that full experience without having to worry about being in the theater with other people, and also being in a theater that is potentially projecting it not that great. But, you know, not always the biggest fan of 3D, but in the Apple Vision Pro, like, this film, because it's usually, like, one thing in the foreground and just dunes in the background, it feels so good, and it communicates the scale of all this shit so well that I was like, holy crap. But yeah, that's the format I watched 2021 Dune in. What format? I assume we both went to the Alamo Drafts House, saw this in 70mm, not
we
IMAX.
Did. Yeah. We did, and I did not revisit part one. I stuck with my lack of memory of part one and just cannonballed into part two. I do have to say, I just Googled 2021 A Space Odyssey, and zero people on the internet have ever made that joke. So it's possible to make a dumb pun and be the, oh, damn it, no, I spelled Odyssey wrong. I spelled it right, and two people have made that joke before.
Very nice.
I take it back.
Well, You know, we both saw it in just regular 70mm. I have a ticket to go see it Sunday morning in our you know, blessed IMAX here in the city. I'm the very, very last seat all the way on the left, but
oh god,
you know, I figured you know, I got to do it one way or another. So
at
I'm
least
excited.
You're not the very front seat all the way on the left. I think that would give you neck problems.
That would be very terrible, but I think I'll be all right. But yeah, I'm excited to watch it again. I'm excited to talk about it now. Should we just get into it, Steven?
Yeah.
All right, we are going to take a listen to the trailer for Dune Part 2 and then come back and give everybody a review.
It's okay. I'm here. It's been a while since you've had one of those nightmares. Tell me, what was it about?
It's only fragments. Nothing's clear. You've been fighting the Harkonnens for decades.
Look!
My family's been fighting them for centuries.
Your blood comes from dukes and great houses. Here, we're equal. What we do for the benefit of all.
Well, I'd very much like to be equal to you.
Maybe I'll show you the way.
Deal with this prophet.
Send assassins.
Fade Rotha. He's psychotic.
I see possible futures all at once. And in so many futures, our enemies prevail. But I do see a way. There is a narrow way through. Is to you. Do you believe me?
This is a form of power that our world has not yet seen. The ultimate power.
I want you to know I will love you as long as I breathe.
You will never lose me as long as you stay who you are.
Consider what you're about to do, Paul Atreides.
Silence!
All right, so that was the trailer for Dune Part 2. As the title says, it is the continuation of 2021's Dune film and rounds out everything that made up the original novel. Stephen Miller, what did you think of Dune Part 2?
So like I mentioned, I went into Part 2 not having rewatched Part 1. I think I skimmed the Wikipedia while I was sitting at Alamo just to be like, okay, is there any major thing that I need to remember happened? And I didn't get very far. And the movie started, and I thought it was fantastic. I think it is significantly better than my memory of Part 1, and apparently my experience of Part 1 was that it was also great. I mean, this one, you know, Part 1 was half a movie, and this time around, even though it is a Part 2, it feels to me like a full movie, like even the beginning to end. It traces a full anti-hero slash hero's journey. There's an arc, a beginning and an end of where all the characters wound up. It reminds you of who every character is. Like, I had no trouble following the logic of who are these people, what do they want, why are they here. There was only one character, which if we get to spoilers, I'll talk about. When he showed up like 30 minutes before the end of the movie, I was like, wait, that guy? Who? I don't remember. I don't remember him existing. But anyway, it does a great job of keeping track of all the characters, being broad, epic, operatic sci-fi in a way that doesn't get boring or make you get so drowned in world building that if you aren't invested, you'll tune out. I thought it had a massively satisfying conclusion, even though they're obviously teeing up future movies. This is not a movie that ends in the middle of something. This is a movie that ends at a very much, okay, that was the story, and now I'm amped for whatever comes next. And of course, the most important thing, it's just a visually stunning movie. It's amazing to look at. All the sand photography is brilliant, obviously, but there are so many little touches that just give it a unique style. Like, Denis Villeneuve makes sure everything is interesting. My favorite of these is probably the kind of gladiator battle that takes place on the Harkonnen planet, where the light on that planet, it is like it's light that is void of all color, basically. It's just a fully desaturated world. It's like bright and overwhelming and black and white in a way that is just incredibly cool, especially given the pale look and feel of the Harkonnens and just the whole, all of it. I thought it was amazing. Like, I thought that battle sequence was just incredible. Riding the sandworms, amazing. You know, love that experience. They really captured the scale of everything that Timmy is having to do, and it just looks beautiful. I also think the cast, especially the new cast, are really good. In a movie where I would think I would be overwhelmed with people and not want any new characters. Like, Austin Butler, I think, is really good as this creepy nephew Harkonnen character, Fade Rautha. It made me realize he's basically the new non-problematic Jared Leto, and I'm like totally here for it. Totally fine for him. I want him to be the Joker in the DC universe. Like, I want him to do all of those annoying roles where he fully gets in character and you kind of hate him, but then you look at him and you're like, damn it, you pulled it off.
It's like anybody who has a very specific voice that you need somebody else to play somebody with that same voice.
Exactly.
Cast this guy.
Obviously, like, I think Timothée Chalamet, I liked him in the first movie, but I think this really shows why he was a smart casting choice, because he's kind of like the sad boy. He's not really the typical hero character that you would cast in a movie like this.
Yeah.
And I think here, showing that arc from being this kind of, like, entitled rich kid, you know, he came straight from Call Me By Your Name or whatever, and now he's, like, the bored son of, you know, someone who leads a planet, and his growth into being a warrior and then being a leader and all of his conflicted feelings about that leadership, I think he handles it amazingly well. Zendaya, I think, is great in this movie. I'm glad that she stuck it out, even though part one gave her nothing to do. Part one must have been a promise that, like, in part two, you will have a real role. And I think the movie's brilliant in how it uses her. And then there's been this narrative on the internet that this movie and Denis Villeneuve in general is beautiful, but dour, joyless, brooding, overly self-serious. Like, I don't know if you've caught this conversation, but it's been happening multiple times on the internet. And Denis giving his quote about how he doesn't care about dialogue. I've heard that quote, yeah. That has fed into it too, where this is a guy that just wants to stare and feel brooding all the time. And don't get me wrong, that's great. I love dour, joyless shit. Like, that's my jam. Yeah. But unless my audience was, you know, on too much of the spice, this movie had multiple times where it felt light and funny. Like, Javier Bardem, I feel like his character many times in the movie is given this kind of over the top. He's like a boomer fundamentalist who is like,
yeah,
his interactions with the younger people, he is so serious and they are not taking him seriously. And the movie had a lot of, I thought, playfulness in it. I did not feel like this was like uncomfortably dour or unpleasant.
Yeah, I my third bullet on my notes here says humor was shocking.
Yeah, exactly.
The first film was so very serious, and I don't think in a, like, I wouldn't call it self-serious. Like, I felt the first one was serious in a good way. But like, the only comedic elements at all was friggin' Aquaman's character's name, like Duncan Mama. Idaho or something like that.
Oh yeah.
But like, that character brought a little bit of humor in the short few moments that he was in it. Like, that character was like quipping and stuff like that, but everything around him was still serious. This film feels incredibly like humorful, where and maybe it's just because the Fremen are humorous people and everyone else is like dour and serious, but there was something, Javier Bardem's character is just so funny, and the way he gets his moments of like His exposition about the prophecy is just him going like, oh my God, it's him.
Yeah.
It's so funny.
Exactly. It's like, it almost feels like he's in another movie, but it completely fits the story they're trying to tell about prophecy and destiny and the potential value and danger of people believing in you. I'll get to that more after I give you a chance to talk. But all I want to say in closing is I think this movie's amazing. I think it rips. It is shocking that Denis made a part two of a giant epic sci-fi and made it be exciting to watch and interesting, even to a person who has not revisited the other one in the last 2 years. And bravo, like no one else does it like him. He, like Nolan, Denis does something that is unique in big budget movies, and I hope he's allowed to keep doing it forever.
Yeah, I think even if you're somebody who isn't vibing with what is happening in the story of these two films, or it's just too convoluted because you haven't read the books. I have not read the books either, so I could understand like that convoluted nature. I think even with all of that, just the visual spectacle alone should be something that can drive you through watching these films. These films are beautiful. Like this second film ups the ante on everything the first film was bringing. Like there were some big battles and some fun stuff in that first film that all looked amazing, especially in 3D. But in this film, there's just some shit that like I haven't seen before in that same way. We can talk more in spoilers about some of these things, but like in particular, there is like a mine fight, I guess you could call it, that happens that I was just like, that's so fucking cool. Yeah. Like it was so visually inventive, and there's like a lot of little, there's kind of like a period of this film that is sort of a montage of sort of these attacks on spice fields that are just very, very inventive. They're kind of like scary in the context of like watching how dangerous it is for these characters to kind of attack these giant machines with just swords. There's just really, really inventive stuff that is visually striking and just kind of like incredible. And then of course, you know, once you get into like worm territory, the scale of what you're dealing with is just like, you watch it and you're like, holy shit, this is the coolest thing I've ever seen. This is amazing. Like if I told you there was going to be a movie that like everything was just going to be sand colored and like nothing should be visually exciting, and yet it still looks so amazing and so pretty. And I loved visually everything this film was doing. I'm actually totally on board for the Paul Chani like weird, it's not really a meet cute exactly, but it's like they're like begrudging start to, I mean, Paul is immediately like, there's a great moment where you're just looking at Paul looking at Johnny.
Yeah.
and I think that was like a moment that like had a good chuckle from people that were watching the film too. But just like their sort of relationship of like she kind of not knowing whether or not to trust him, and him really wanting her to help him, and kind of like where that goes and blossoms and stuff like that. We can talk more in spoilers about like some of the ways their story may or may not differ from like the book and stuff like that. But yeah, as I said, my third bullet was just like the humor. It kind of like, I wasn't expecting the humor at all because I just watched the first film, which was almost devoid of humor. And then the humor really, really brought you in. I think, as you mentioned, the casting is great, but it's like, it's incredible. It's not just great. It's like perfect, pitch perfect casting. There are so many people in this film that like you could argue are stunt cast. Like basically every new character that wasn't in the previous film,
right?
In a way, is stunt casting. But you're kind of like, that's so fucking smart.
Yeah,
like the way the people they chose to play these roles, it's just like, you freaking genius casting director.
Like, you're probably thinking of this too, like Christopher Walken would normally be like a very stunty role, and I actually think that is brilliant for what he has to do.
I he is my least favorite of the stunt casting, I will say. But even so far as like the actress's name,
Florence Pugh.
No, not Florence Pugh. The blue is the warmest color.
Leah Seydoux.
Yeah. Like her being that role on that planet, I was like, it fits so well. Like visually, her facial features match with like the people of that planet. Like it just felt like good. obviously there's somebody you see standing on a shoreline at some point where I was like, yep. Yeah, fuck it, of course. Like,
of course, exactly.
Who else would you cast in this role? There were just so many moments where I was just kind of like, in my head, I'm just like, I want to stand up and clap and go like, yep, you did it. That was
really do a good job. It's a very impressively cast movie. And it's also, like you said, it could look like stunt casting because it's kind of a who's who of, you know, young actors and actresses, basically. Like, this is a movie that I think it takes a thing that feels very middle-aged man, which is like big sci-fi epic from, you know, based on a novel from a long time ago. And it fills it with people who will, like, anecdotally, Joanna does not go to see a lot of these movies with me. You know, she's not always into the idea.
Yeah.
She is definitely not into like hyper-violent things or like overly self-serious, long, complicated dramas. She wanted to see this bad because of who is in it. And normally, if that were true, it would be the story of a movie that like sold its soul or got this cast just to like bring in the Zoomer crowd or something like that, and then you'd look and you'd be like, oh god, this is a nightmare. But it is perfect. Everyone is famous and everyone is amazingly right for the role that they're playing.
Yeah. And like, going back to what you were talking about, that Coliseum sort of fight scene in the middle of this film, you know, you see glimpses of that in the trailer, and in my head, just with like, you know, my dumb brain was like, oh, it's black and white. It must be a flashback. That must be young Baron or something like that. Mm.
But the thing is, it isn't black and white in the shadows. It's black and white when the sun is shining on it.
And there's one, like, once again, didn't read the books or anything, but there's one line where, like, the guy, the announcer for the Coliseum is like, as we join here tonight under our black sun. And I was like, oh, it's something about the sun that just doesn't let the color escape. I was like, that's so fucking cool. Like, their sun doesn't have those wavelengths of color, but like having people be indoors and move to a window to look and have the color disappear from them as they transition into the beam that's coming from the window, all that shit was like super, super cool.
I have to say, by the way, your announcer voice is 100% the voice that you hate. It's a wonderful day.
What's funny,
and I love that you knew what I was gonna say before I said it.
I knew exactly where we were going, and I was like, yep, I did the arm motion too. Oh, busted. But yeah, the thing that I want to say is, like, you know, like, as you said, this movie rips. This movie is fucking awesome. I'm gonna blow you away with my like minor complaint about this film.
I know what it's gonna be, and it's gonna be shocking because it's mine too. But you never think about this stuff anyway. Give it.
It might not be the same thing, but okay. So my main complaint with this film, the first film, my main complaint with it was that it was half a movie. My big complaint with this film is I think this should have been three movies to tell the one story. Because my big complaint is that this film has to shorthand so many things. And we can get into it in spoiler. I have a list of things where it's like a character says, so-and-so will never do X. And then the next scene is them doing X, right? It's just like this whole film is...
Well, it's a rave. Like, you have to...
Yeah.
It's the spice, dude.
Yeah, I get it. But it's like a thing where it's like there's so many things that I feel like I wish I had more time because it feels rushed. It feels a little last season of Game of Thronesy where it's like, these are the beats I have to hit. So let's hit them and get past them. And it wasn't that it like took away. It's that I felt robbed of the experience to experience all of it. What I think, because given that, you know, the first movie had a good stopping point, right? The attack happens, they arrive, they meet the Fremen, they have that small conflict, and then boom, movie's over. The second movie starts and continues on from there. I think this film could have ended, still be 3 hours long, but end at the end of the scene.
Does it end in a shoreline?
Not in a shoreline. I think it should have ended in the gathering spot where all the people are talking.
Yep. Okay.
You could have ended it right there at the end of that, where he, you know.
So you want to really stretch out the last act of this movie, basically. Because in my memory, the moment you're talking about is like three quarters of the way through the movie.
Yeah. Well, three quarters of the way. That's exactly. That's like, split that off. So for me, it's less about extending out the final act and more extending the middle act into the full 3 hours that this film, you know, I know it wasn't exactly 3 hours, but basically. I think that I would have loved to have more time with him integrating with the Fremen instead of just immediately being there and kind of being like, yeah, remember at the end of the movie where I did that fight and I won that challenge and now the Fremen people like me except for the two guys in the middle of that cave who are like, they could be spies. Like, I wanted so much more time to spend with these characters. And then it feels like that is a natural point where that you could have totally broken off this film ending there, because it feels at least as climaxy as the first film. and that would have been a good stopping point. And the rest of it could be all the stuff that, like, when all of the, you know, I mean, the third film would just be too much for people to handle, maybe, if you did that. But it would have been rad. And then the only other thing that I'll say before I throw it back to you is, I think, to me, it's kind of funny that you said this film has a nice finality to it, because I feel like he adds a clip. Like, I know that there's more books after the first book, but it feels like the first book actually ended with a pretty finite place, where the character was worried about the future, but the future wasn't immediately right there. Right. And I feel like this film ends in more of a cliffhanger than the first film did, right? Like, it feels like this is more like blah blah. Like, we'll talk about it in spoilers, but to me, it was just funny that the book has an ending, and he made the ending more cliffhangery, which probably leads to why I feel like there could have been a third film of just the first book. But yeah, back to you.
I get it. I hear what you're saying. I like the cliffhanger, because to me, the cliffhanger now is the kind of cliffhanger you would get at the end of a movie that might get a sequel, which is very different from being part one of a saga that needs a part two, you know? And I think the movie, the last thing I'll say before spoilers is there's been another rising narrative I've seen on the internet. I just need to get off the internet. The internet is terrible. But there's been a rising narrative, which is the easiest shot you could possibly make without thinking for 2 seconds. Which is the Dune is a white savior narrative movie. Cool movie, fun movie, white savior in the desert. And I get it, right? Like, you look at it, it is obviously that. All I want to say is this movie is steering into that 100% from the beginning. It is about the fact that it is a white savior narrative. And Denis constructed the whole movie to make that be a scary, complicated, uncomfortable situation that was happening. And it just, I feel like there's still going to be a story after this, that it's like a problematic movie that is all about this. And maybe someone will have a good take, don't get me wrong, but I think the basic read of that is a bad take that is intentionally ignoring what the whole movie is about. Well, and there's something to me that feels like I feel like, short of changing who the characters are in the movie, he did the absolute best thing you can do with a classic mildly problematic sci-fi, which is complicate it by bringing in other people who express their strong feelings. And the reason I want to talk about that right now is because I think ending it the way he does amplifies that feeling that we are not in a moment of triumph. We are a moment of, shit, what is going to happen? And I think if it ended triumphantly, people would have a leg to stand on with that argument. And because it doesn't, I think the movie front to back is like very daringly deconstructing the whole idea of a white savior narrative. My little rant.
There's also the fact that not only is it portrayed as not necessarily a good thing, but also, and this is based on the first film too, so this isn't exactly a spoiler, but essentially the Bene Gesserits have been practicing eugenics for centuries to try to produce a white savior. So
right, exactly.
So I mean, it's not exactly saying like, isn't it great that this white dude has all this power and people are following him? It's clearly a group of people have been trying to make this happen, and then maybe it's happening now. So
That, we can talk in spoilers, but that is why I think the amplification of Zendaya's character is such a smart thing that the movie did, because it is like her and Javier Bardem are essentially like the commentary on that throughout the whole movie. And it annoys me when people do like a cursory read of a thing and criticize it when it's like they're literally about that, like they're talking all about the thing that you're criticizing it for.
Cool. I mean, it sounds like we are excited to get into spoilers. So maybe before we do that, for people who aren't going to stick around for spoilers, let's go ahead and get to verdicts. Stephen Miller, if you're going to give the same must-see, recommend with a caveat, wait for until passed with a caveat, or a must-avoid, what would you give it?
I have to give it a must-see. I liked it more than the first one, and apparently the first one was a must-see. I think this movie is awesome. I think it's an amazing accomplishment. I'll add my little caveat that doesn't actually caveat the review. I still, pound for pound, would prefer things other than grand sci-fi epics if you talk about like my favorite genre. But in that genre, I think Denis is doing the best you could possibly do with this material. Like, I think it is a fantastically realized story from a famously difficult to adapt novel, and I think that is just amazing.
Yeah,
it may be like Dune. Why I never thought I would like Dune.
Yeah. So before I get into my verdict, which is obviously must see, just since you brought that up now, how does Denis get out of this IP now? Because
yeah,
I mean,
or the meta IP between this and Blade Runner. Like, it feels like he is establishing himself as the guy that does this and knows how to pull off the impossible thing.
Yeah.
And do you think he does Nolan and just gets bigger and bigger and bigger? Because I loved his smaller movies too. Like, I think he was great in like with Enemy or Prisoner or Incendies and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Arrival made me cry a lot. I would love for him to do an Arrival again instead. I don't know if that'll ever happen. Yeah. I don't know how he gets out of it.
Yeah. I have no solution either. You know, while we're praising him, I'm just like, is he just stuck now? Does he just do this for the rest of his life?
Yeah. If not the Dune saga, is there a word for the universe that the Dune books all live in?
I would not know.
Okay. Well, if not for this specific thing, I am afraid that he's kind of going to be like a Nolan, which isn't a bad thing, where I think Nolan feels like I have this very unique gift that has been given to me, which is I'm allowed to make big budget movies. And because no one else is able to play with a big budget the way that I am going to keep doing that. I'm not like Nolan is never going to make another Memento. Right.
Yeah.
And I do feel like Denis might get stuck in that loop where he's never going to go back and make another, you know, tiny intense movie, because now it needs to be like a grand, many hundred million budget. And that's okay. Good on him. But I hope he finds a way out, I guess, because I think he's really good at more than just this.
Yeah. I mean, I guess now, at least, if they somehow convince him to keep doing it up, he can at least make more of it all at once instead of like not even casting the people in the second half of the movie until after the first one's been released.
I mean, we'll talk about it in spoilers, but there is an actress who's basically the equivalent of the Zendaya casting, where it's like it only makes sense if she was promised that there will be another movie.
Yeah.
That if there is another movie, her role would be bigger.
Yeah, for sure. But yeah, so it's must see for me as well. As I said, I already have my ticket to go rewatch this in our big old IMAX here in the city. So I'm excited to do that. And yeah, we are about to transition to spoilers. So for people who aren't gonna join us in spoilers, Steven, where can people find you throughout the week if they'd like to do so?
People can find me at S. David Miller on all social platforms or sdavidmiller.com.
People can find me at ChristopherMillerLife.com or ChristopherIRL on a number of places. You can find the podcast over at thespoilerwarning.com, where you can get a bunch of the back episodes of the show. If you want to subscribe to the show, you can do so in Overcast, YouTube, Apple Podcasts, or wherever podcasts are found. If you want to know when the episodes go live, you can follow us at twitter.com/spoilerwarning, facebook.com/thespoilerwarning, or instagram.com/thespoilerwarning. If you want to get a hold of us directly, you can send an email to fans@thespoilerwarning.com, or you can use the contact form on the site. Music for this episode will come from a track selected from artlist.io, so hopefully you are enjoying that. That music is playing now. Sandworms in a desert, those are going to rise from the surface. It's going to peek out at the top, hang out there for a little bit, and then dive back down, and we will be in full-blown spoilers to talk with you there. I always
beautiful.
I always love watching Steven's face when I just... try to transition into the spoiler.
I was just trying to make it be a State Farm thing, but I couldn't tie it into the worms.
All right, well, yeah, we'll see you in a second. All right, We are back. This is spoiler territory. It's the after part of our review of Dune Part 2. We're talking full-blown spoilers. I guess you can just consider spoilers for both Dune and Dune Part 2 all wrapped into one.
Except none for me for Part 1 because I do not remember it.
Because you don't remember it. Okay, cool. Spoilers for whatever part of the Wikipedia Stephen made it through in the 2 minutes he had between arriving at the theater and the movie starting. Do you want to talk about some more like cool stuff that you enjoyed about it just now that we're in spoiler territory?
Yeah, I don't know where to start. I'll start with the thing that I was skeptical of, actually. The thing I was skeptical of was, so I hinted that there's one character who I did not remember at all. That is played by Josh Brolin. Don't ask me the name of the character because I don't remember. late in the movie, Brolin appears and is suddenly like, hey, man, I'm on your side. And then he reminds Paul that there is an atomic store, basically, that was passed down through his family, and he gives it to him.
Like a store for of me, atomic materials, not like a store you can go
not,
to.
Yeah, not like a shopping situation. For me, the idea of, this movie is going to be about like giant bombs now, it didn't feel like it fit in the Dune universe. Like visually, it seemed like it would not be fun to watch that at all. And even that, like there's a final battle, which does have hand-to-hand combat and a lot of other stuff, but it also has like massive artillery. Yeah. And to me, I thought that would be boring just by virtue of whatever, the way they were framing it. And I thought it was really, really, really cool. Like the movie nails everything, including the big fight sequence at the end. So that was kind of a surprise for me that it did that well.
Yeah, I think it's sort of like introduced as like a way to, you know, it's a means to say like, hey, worst case scenario, our contingency plan is to just nuke the entire planet and call it a day. No more spice. We die here. They all die here because they can't transport back. It's like literally the nuclear option. for me, it was kind of like part of my, because I know certain, like the way they use it is awesome to like hit the ridge to allow the worms to come in.
Yeah.
And that's how they use it in the original stuff too, I believe. But there was some funny thing in my head where I was like, I get that you want to have the showdown with the Emperor in the Emperor's chamber at the end.
Yeah, why not just hit it a couple more times?
Just shoot the Emperor's ship with one of the nukes. Like,
I feel that with almost any battle sequence in anything, which why are people dying for this? Can't they just keep firing, you know, bombs instead?
Yeah, so it was interesting, though, like what they did, though. I do want to talk a little bit about, though, like I noticed this one, it's sort of a... You know, this is not a complete thought. I just kind of scribbled out these things to kind of like there's an interesting focus on the female characters in this film. And there's some interesting that it's doing that's like partially a departure from the book, and partially just like an interesting way to handle these characters. Like one is that the character of Jessica, Rebecca Ferguson's character, to me, she's the main character of the story of these two films. Like, she, like, yes, we are following Paul. We are following Timothy Chalamet. Yeah. But she's the one moving the chess pieces the entire time.
Right. She's the Adjustment Bureau, basically.
She's the Adjustment Bureau. You know, her whole organization, the Bene Jesuits, or Jesuits, I forget how to spell it. But they have been doing this all in all. But she's the one that sort of was like, hey, we as a group are doing this, but I'm going to shimmy off and do my own thing. I'm going to purposely give birth to a male character. So instead of producing women who marry into these high, powerful families, I'm going to produce the heir to one of these families, one that I can control and move across the board, and then make him into the thing that we've been prophesying for so long. And this film literally ends with her sitting on what you could arguably call a throne. Maybe it's just the religious chair, but
she's the Cersei of this universe.
Yeah. And it's like, there was something I dug about that. Like upon, you know, in the first film, she feels very like her assertiveness with Paul feels like it's her trying to be protective of him, right? Like teach him and protect it. And it's only on like second watch and the course of this film that I realized that there was something stronger and more aggressive there that was not, I need to keep you safe, but it was like, you need to accomplish my goals because I want to sit on this little religious throne and be the whatever, the grand mother of whatever, like whatever her thing is. But yeah, so I thought that was super, super interesting. The Aaliyah character, whatever the Paul's in womb sister is.
Anya.
So she is in the, you know, in the 80s film and in the book, she's like actually born. Like she comes out and is like a small child, but with like the powers of a grown ass adult, right? So it was interesting to have the decision to have her be in the womb. But she's also the one that kills the Baron. And it was an interesting choice to have her sort of be this extra force that sort of lets Paul know of his real true lineage and give him the chance to kill the Baron. Like that was kind of like an interesting reversal of that, and make it to where it's like he learns about his true lineage, goes in and kills his uncle essentially, and like it was interesting the way they move that off to that and let her be this like ethereal character who's kind of speaking or participating in his visions from the future, as you said, as like this potential future film where she's going to be way more important. Also, Chani in the books has like a child with him, and like they remove that as a piece, right? Like obviously they still are falling in love and they have their intimacy and stuff like that, but they don't produce an heir, or not heir, but they don't produce a child together. And at the end of this film,
at least not that we know of. I don't remember. Does it hint that she might be pregnant? Because we definitely are shown that they have sex at least once.
Yeah, I feel like if they like, maybe it's still going to be a reveal in a future film. But like basically the way that. The way that the original film ends, or so the way that the book and the film ends is she doesn't run away, right? Like Jessica tells her, like, hey, that woman who is now going to be his wife is actually going to be more like a concubine. And the two of us who are actual concubines in this context are actually through history going to be known as the wives of these men that we were attached to. So it's like she has a reason to stay, and this film like essentially liberates her from that and gives her a chance to say like, no, I will not bow to Paul. You know, one of my big complaints that we'll get to in my checklist later, which is like literally he goes, Johnny, I will love you until my last breath, turns around and goes, you are now my wife, woman.
And it's like, it's one of those classic, like, you could have talked a little more first.
It could have been, or you could add more to your sentence, like, I will love you, but I have to do this for political reasons. I will always love you, though.
But I mean, I think, you know, you talked about extending this into three movies, and you wanted the middle section to be bigger. But for me, the end is where I started to really get the Game of Thrones season 8 feeling, where I don't know, I wasn't looking at my watch, but I feel like the gap between Paul embracing the idea of being a messiah as opposed to running from it, from that to the end of the movie, I feel like is like 30 minutes. And I feel so much happens after that whiplash of his death and rebirth and being the messiah, and the horror that Chani feels at his shift is so quick. It works for this movie because this movie becomes outside looking in, terrified of, oh my God, this guy is amassing so much power. Whatever happened to him after he drank like the worm juice? It has destroyed whatever inner part of him made him worried about power or aware of the effect he had on people. And from then on, it's like we're watching Paul as this, he has hints of who he used to be. And I feel like saying, whatever happens, I will always love you, is like a hint of who he used to be, but he is not looping anyone in anymore. He's moving according to the chess pieces that have been laid out for him. And I think a full movie would have been cool to make us actually feel that evolution. But I kind of like, as a horror story of like, oh my God, this is what happened. Again, I keep comparing to Game of Thrones, but it's like the Game of Thrones thing again, basically, where it's like, oh my God, you finally have power and immediately I'm terrified of you now.
You just realized me, they 100% should have Game of Thrones it. So three movies, and the movie literally ends with him drinking the blue juice and dying. And then the whole, like, it's the cliffhanger is Paul dead? And like, you know, we will know that he's not because of where the stories are, but that would have been like can you imagine sitting in a theater with like no context for where the story is supposed to go and just seeing Paul drink some juice and then die and then credits roll? Dude, people would be like,
amazing.
Oh my God. Yeah, real
I
fast.
Definitely thought, by the way, that Paul was going to die at the end of this movie. Except, like, the only reason I thought he probably wouldn't was that I knew the name of the next book was Messiah. And I was like, if that's not Paul, I don't know what they're doing. But maybe Messiah isn't about Paul. Maybe it's about his sister, yeah. And you don't need to make a face or tell me.
No. I was going to say, or maybe it's just about any of the other pairings of the woman in the clan with some powerful guy. Like, because that was one of the things that I actually liked is they basically... I mean, they more than imply, they show, but like essentially they've just been doing this around the galaxy for centuries trying to produce the Messiah. So it would be fine for a Messiah to come in from left field suddenly in the next book. It would make sense. But the last thing I wanted to talk about of like interesting things that they've done with some of the women characters in this is, you know, Florence Pugh barely in this film, right? She's shown to kind of have knowledge of what is happening with Paul because she's like diarying and the weird cylinder things that are also kind of cool. One of the little reversals that they do is at the end of the movie and the book, I guess, the emperor is like, oh, I can see it. I don't want to die. So take my daughter. And in this film, she basically offers herself up to spare her father. So it's like, it's still kind of not full agency, but it's not she is not a pawn being given against her own will. Though she's not excited about it, is like, I will take this action to do it.
Does she offer it? I feel like Paul is the one who dictates it, this is what's going to happen.
She says, if you spare my father, I will gladly take care. I forget exactly what the line is, but she... Like, obviously, they've been talking about it in front of her already, so it's not like it's her idea, but she is like, hey, you do this for me, I will make this alliance with you, and we will rule together. Like, she basically volunteers to accept the invitation as opposed to being the emperor saying, okay, I decree that you are now marrying my daughter, and that's forceful. So it's kind of like an interesting little reversal they're trying to do there.
Interesting. Yeah, I didn't know anything about the source material, but I felt, just knowing how sci-fi historically has worked, I assumed the increased agency and importance of the female characters was very much a modern thing that doing. But in every case, I feel like it made the movie better. I think it is way more interesting because of having all of these people on the chessboard who have actual competing desires and aims, you know? And I can't stress enough how much I think Zendaya's character is crucial to this movie playing the way Denis clearly wanted it to play, which is, again, a reversal of we are rooting for this guy to rise up because he has the kind of Jon Snow, like, I don't want the power, I don't want it, you know, and suddenly he does the, when the reversal happens and he wants it, the horror and for her, the feeling of everything I've been saying since the beginning of the movie about the danger of prophecy, of believing in a Messiah, the way we're just going to have one dictator replaced with another one. Watching her realize that has come true is, like, to me, the arc of the movie. Yeah. And I think it just works really well.
Yeah, and I think that's another reason why it would have been super interesting if it did break with him dying after drinking the juice, because then he can come back in a follow-up film being a wildly different character, because it's all a response to that moment. And when you're experiencing it in real time, it feels like a sudden change. And if you're not buying into that, this is the effect of a combination of like high doses of spice mixed with like the intestinal juices of a worm. You know, like you might be like, huh, he seems to like suddenly changed his tone, but if you had that gap to sit with, like this like has literally changed him, it might be easier to swallow. Yeah.
Little known fact, they actually took that scene from Beautiful Boy and just added some CGI.
Nice. So you want to just talk about some shit that we loved? Or do you have any other specific topics?
I talked about, it's obvious, but riding the sandworms, not just the first time, but then seeing all the worms going into battle together, and like people are like heading in different directions, leading battalions, or just traveling to the south on the worm. Love that. Big fan of all that. I'm always, ever since I was a kid, fascinated by bad guys who are real bad. You know, they're the coolest action figures. They're the ones that I want to play with. The Harkonnens, like this... I'm not going to say subtle, but this recurring thing in their story where they just like murder people because they're angry or because they get their rocks off for it is so like depraved in a way that I completely love for like the big bad of this movie.
I don't know if they're all that way. It seems like Austin Butler's character is a little bit more like masochistic. Like the other guys love fighting, but they're fighting their enemies, right? He's just like, he has pets that he's killing to feed each other and stuff.
It show like Stellan Skarsgård also doing that? Like we see him in a chamber and then there are like two women that have been murdered. I feel like it's implying that this is a thing that they do.
Maybe.
Yeah, I felt like it was implied. We don't see Dave Bautista do it. He's kind of like he's the Harkonnen with the heart of gold, basically, compared to the other two.
Yeah, I gotcha. Yeah, so you talked about all the worm stuff looking dope. My all-time favorite worm shot is the implied moment that you don't technically see, but it's like it's that shot looking like right into the sun, and you see just dust flying everywhere off the ridge of this like dune, and you see kind of a worm dip down, and then as the dust starts to part, friggin' just slow-mo Timothée Chalamet walking out of the dust, and it's like that means he was riding the thing and then it banked and then he just slid off the front into a fucking badass walk. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like it's basically the worm equivalent of Cool Guys Don't Look at Explosions.
Yep.
And I'm fucking 100% there for it.
I was going to say it's the worm equivalent of like sliding over the hood of a car.
Yeah, I basically like
both of them.
It is. Or no, it's the worm equivalent of the skidding out your car, opening the door and getting out of it while the car skids off. That's what it is.
So this reminds me of the one kind of criticism I have, which could have been spoiler free. I just forgot. It's what I thought you were going to say what I was going to be shocked that you had. I don't like part of the score in this movie in a way that is distracting. Namely, the one thing this movie does that I do think fits with the criticism of the white savior narrative is the classic vaguely Middle Eastern singing chant that they keep doing whenever it is showing a desert scene. I was just annoyed by that. I feel like it didn't need to happen. It didn't add anything to it. It'd be so easy to do something else that isn't just like tropey as hell.
Wait, are you saying I gotta change my song for this episode?
Yeah. The song you showed me is actually fine.
Okay.
This is specifically the thing where they take like almost like the call to prayer sound. And it's the same in like Rosewater, which is a movie I'm probably the only person who remembers exists.
No, I remember. That was the John Stewart directed movie.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Movies like that as like the shorthand for like cut to, you know, Iran or something.
Yeah.
They always have that kind of like opening song and it just drives me crazy.
Yeah. All right. One other badass thing. Steven, the Emperor's ship is also the Emperor's capital city. Like when it lands, it just puts out an entire palace and all that kind of shit. That was fucking badass. Like maybe that's straight from the books, but just seeing that like sphere ship come down and then the next time you see it, it's just a whole city has manifested itself underneath it. And I was like, all right, that was pretty cool. Like, I don't know if it was like Tony Stark, nanobots that created that entire city, but they don't at least show that part. You just see the final product and I'm like, that looks fucking rad.
Yeah, it's very cool. One thing about the compressed storytelling in this movie is it took me until right now to close what I thought was a plot hole, which is how did they get so lucky to have the Emperor and the Baron in the same place at the same time when they attacked? And then I remembered Paul sends that seal to the Emperor. He's goading him. And presumably their plan includes waiting for the Emperor to come down and they're tracking that and that's what they do. But I feel like it goes by in like 5 minutes of wordless dialogue in a way where I couldn't quite track what it was that they were doing.
And I think too, I don't know if that's a change or in the same vein, but like I think in the book, there's something about the Emperor already mistrusting the Harkonnens or whatever on the planet. And like he was already interested in showing up to like he sends spies to see what they're doing. And I think that's a line of dialogue that was even in this trailer where it's like they're they're trying to deal with, or maybe that was the Baron that said that about, I don't know. Anyways, I think there was already some mistrust. So there was like another reason to be at the planet. But yeah, in this one, it's totally Paul goading him to get him there. Which is like the other badass thing is like two scenes where Paul like kills it. One, he actually kills it. And two, he just kills it like visually and emotionally is when he comes into the chamber and they're like, you're not allowed to speak here. And he's like, he just goes up and then turns to every single person and tells them the exact thing that lets them know that he can see them. Like there was something about that that was just like super badass. And plus like that whole set, I'm going to call it a set. It has to be, you know, there has to be CG being used there because I don't think they got like 50,000 extras inside of a cave that they carved out just to make that scene. But it just looks amazing. Those like beams of light coming to the ceiling and just him going up and like telling everybody exactly what they need to hear. And like the leader of that group, like bowing to him and then everybody else behind them bowing to him. You know, once again, it's still savior moment, but it's still also,
it's savior moment in a way where at that point it's cool and scary. Like, I don't think that point you're like, hell yeah, go be God, man. It's kind of like, oh shit.
It's like the shit is really getting real now. But then also just when he goes in and kills the Baron, and like nobody even, everybody just watches it happen. And what's funny is right before that moment, the Baron is slowly crawling to the, it looks like he's trying to crawl to the Emperor's throne. Like, I know he's got knocked off his little flying device and he doesn't have his little tubes that feed him maybe the slaughtered people that you were talking about earlier, whatever it's doing. But it almost feels like there's like that level of just patheticness where he knows he's beat, but he just wants to maybe sit in that throne once before he dies. And then Paul just walks in and is like, hey, Unk, and then kills him. The only thing I wish, because like there's this close-up shot of his hand afterwards and his ring, like, you know, he's so big that like his ring is what is usually on the people's wrist to turn on the shield. And like, you know, there's that scene in the first film where you got the little, the thing in the tooth, the gas thing.
Yep.
And it's like, he's talking and he's like, I need to lean in, but he like flicks his finger and turns on the thing and then reaches down and then he breathes out the gas, you know. I wanted him to like pathetically try to turn on the shield, but because Paul just has to slowly plunge a knife in him, he would have to suffer through the knowing that his shield will not stop that, and just like seeing the shield go blue to red to dead like would have been that would have been awesome.
Yeah, that would have been cool. I mean, I'm a sucker for Baron Harkonnen in general. It is one thing I remember even from my dad was watching the, like, I think it was the Sci-Fi Channel had a miniseries at some point in the early 2000s.
Yeah.
And my dad watched it. And so I have like childhood / teenage memories of just vaguely seeing it. And all I remember is big bald guy floating in a chair. And I was like, hell yeah, this rocks.
Yeah. All right, now can I get to my checklist of?
Yeah, give me the nitpicks.
It's technically one big nitpick, but it's just an example of all the different pieces. So I was saying before that like my big nitpick is it's so condensed that what we get is a bunch of scenes where somebody says this can't happen, and then it immediately happens in the next scene. There's a comedian who I'm pretty sure was like canceled way before it was cool to be canceled. But he had this like bit where he'd be like, so I'm going to do a thing that is like this. And then he'd pause for a second and go, so I'm doing that thing. And that was like his whole, like he would do this. Like,
I don't even know if this guy is canceled, but just from canceled before you could get canceled, I'm going to say it's Tom Segura.
It's not Tom Segura. But anyway, so it reminded me of that kind of thing where it's like, he'll never learn the ways of the desert. Next scene is him learning the ways of the desert. He can never ride a worm. Next scene is him riding the worm. He can never drink the blue stuff. Next scene is him drinking the blue stuff. He can never speak in the chamber. Next scene is him speaking in the chamber. No one will ever follow him. Next scene is everybody following him. He can't use the nukes. Next scene is him using the nukes. He can't go north. Next scene is him going, I'm going to go north. And then there's the worst one, which is, I'll love you till my last breath. And then immediately not loving her with his current breath. So that was like my big nitpick. And then I've already praised the choice to let Johnny decide not to partake and go off. But in the moment, I was in my head, I was like, but you could just be a concubine.
You could be a concubine.
Like, but no, like it was one of those things.
What's not rad about that?
No, I mean, like, obviously that's just the language they're using. But like, clearly, if you're in a political marriage, you could totally just, like, they're just married for the sake of everybody paying attention to it. It's not like a thing where, like, it has to mean anything other than being a political marriage. But they give her the choice to run off. And like, after I went back and like, I pulled up the audiobook that I've never listened to and just listened to the last chapter. So at the end, when like Jessica's literally telling her, look, you and I are technically concubines, but that woman will never know his actual affection. You and I will be known to the world, or to the universe, to history, as being the wives of these two men. Like, I was like, oh, okay, so that's what the book did. And then I like retroactively was like, all right, I'm fine with that as an ending, because I could see what they were trying to do and why they were trying to change it up. I definitely
don't... And I also think the ending is not her just being brokenhearted and storming off. It's the whole buildup of Paul taking control. Like, she wants the Fremen to be in charge of land. She doesn't want them to be under the Dominion and be pawns in some game. So I feel like no matter what he did, she was going to leave. Like, I think she even had a line where she was like, I'm fighting for my people, I'm not fighting for you, you know, before this happened.
Because in that moment, he makes the Emperor kiss his ring, and then everybody else slowly starts to bow. And she refuses to bow. It's not just that she leaves. She's like, I'm not submitting to you as my leader. I am going to go run off. Maybe she has, like, I know she has, like, her little friend group, her little clique, but I don't know if, like,
I don't. You need that after a breakup, you know?
I don't know if she's going to be able to, like, I don't know how many people she'll be able to pull. Once again, I don't know anything about future books, but it was just the thing in the moment that bothered me. And then we already talked about how, like, to me, it is a cliffhanger ending, because in the book, he is now emperor, right? He is officially sitting on the throne, going to be married to the daughter of the once was emperor. He has usurped his power. And the book ends with him being worried that he cannot stop the jihad that is about to happen with all the Fremen because of what he put in motion. So it's this fear and this looming expectation of what's to come next. But in the film, it's literally like, oh, all the other houses are already in orbit and they refuse to acknowledge me. All right, Fremen, even though you've lived on a desert planet, which I'm pretty sure had no intergalactic ships, you are now going to go take all the intergalactic ships that are parked outside on the lawn and fly into space and wage a giant war. So it's like, to me, that is a bigger cliffhanger. That, like, it's hard for me to not watch that as a cliffhanger. It doesn't feel finite because it's literally, all right, they said, we don't recognize you, let's go fuck them up.
Yeah, I get it. It's weird how much I can't stop thinking of Game of Thrones when I talk about this movie. Yeah. But like, the Fremen and the Free Folk in the North are like very similar ideas, right? Yeah, and there's the same tug of war of, they have a cautious alliance with Jon Snow, and then at a certain point they're following him. And then, you know, I believe there are moments in the show where it's like unclear who they're serving, and are they still retaining their identity, or have they just become pawns in some game that wasn't meant to include them? And this movie totally feels like that too, in a way where it's definitely a cliffhanger because I want to know what happens next, but I also feel like, as a dot 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 of just like the cycle continues, people are being exploited again, it also works even if you never get another movie, just of like, this is the way power operates, you know. It just corrupts people and it preys upon whatever they think they want, and even if it's genuine in the moment, and even if the guy thinks he's going to do the right thing, eventually it corrupts absolutely. And I feel like it would be a totally fine statement if a third movie never got made, but I haven't looked at the box office, but I'm pretty damn sure a third movie is going to get made. So I think we are going to get to see it,
or a third, or two third movies. Well, I mean, technically, with the way they left it off, the entire movie could take place just in the atmosphere of above Arrakis, so it might be a short movie.
It's going to be Messiah with one eye and then Messiah with two eyes as the two parts.
Doubling down on that, Messiah with one eye is just Paul. Messiah with two eyes is him and his sister.
Oh, yeah. Got two of them. Because I think this movie... makes explicit in the conversations that Jessica, is that her name?
Jessica's the mother, Aaliyah like that is the sister.
Yeah. Yeah, the conversation that the mother is having with the sister. I think the movie makes it clear that the mother doesn't actually believe Paul is the Messiah. The mother believes the Messiah is the unborn child, and Paul is just like the way to get all the pieces in place on the board. I don't know. I don't have proof to back it up, but that is the feeling that I had repeatedly, is that the sister was the one who was actually super special, and Paul was just going to be the power grabber who could be used in this way.
So I think... Because I think Paul can't be in his until he drinks the blue goo. Because I think the baby tells her she needs to drink the blue. He needs to drink the blue goo to actually unlock everything. Because that's when he like suddenly can see the past, present, and future, or whatever. And that's like where like now all of his he can actually use. Like that's when he sees his sister as a grown up sister, and finds out that he's actually from the lineage of the Baron. And so it's like that's when they communicate together. So it might just be that she, like, they might be like a Luke and Leia situation. You know what I mean? And they're just trying to, she was like, in order for, like, I fulfilled my power by being in your womb while you drank the blue goo. Now your son outside of the womb needs to also drink the blue goo so that he and I can commune, so that we together can be the Messiah. With two eyes.
Yeah.
The Masuya.
I like it. This podcast episode is sponsored by Blue Goo, by the way, guys. If you've ever needed, you know, we've all been there. That is a joke only for people who listen to shitty podcasts.
Or don't run ad blockers. I mean, if your worm is stuck below the sand.
Exactly.
Oh, any last, I don't think I need to go through my bullets of all the stuff that I looked up about the differences between the books and stuff. Are there any last thoughts you want to say about this before we transition off into not recording anymore?
I feel good. I think this movie is awesome. It just builds up in a very beautiful operatic way. There isn't a dull moment as far as I'm concerned. It is gripping the whole time. It always looks amazing. It keeps your attention. It shakes things up, even though it is sand most of the time. It does find a way to make that visually compelling and different every few minutes. And yeah, it's just a remarkable achievement.
Yeah. Great. Well, thank you everybody for listening. Hope you also agree and enjoyed this film. And we will be back soon with another review. Bye.
Bye.